Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Do you know that every car comes with a chair of stories? That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date? The luxury package you got after a big promotion? Or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer? While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car is worth when it's time to sell it or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar, simply enter your license plate number, and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few simple questions. Once you're finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
Can I say that you're an asshole?
You can. They can hear you now.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
This is Marlon Wayans.
I'm Eli Roth.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Hey everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
I've often said that if you're in this business long enough, you're going to continually run into the same people. And Anna Faris is no exception for me. She and I have known each other a long time, both socially and professionally. We've had a number of times where we got very close to doing something together, and for whatever reason, the movie didn't pan out, or it didn't work out with her schedule, or the movie didn't go. And she has then gone on to work with a lot of the same people that I know. And so, again, if you are doing this job for a long time, you've got to treat people well. You've got to be a person of your word. You've got to keep your integrity, because down the line, you will run into them, you will work with them, and you will maybe need them for a favor. As I did on this live edition of the podcast, I was presented with this opportunity to do my podcast live, which is terrifying. And I wanted to make sure that I had the right person to do it with. And that person was Anna Faris. She's an amazingly talented comedian, really, really, really nice person, very fun. And she has her own podcast, which is hugely successful. You'll notice as we kind of go through this very loose exchange between friends that she puts her podcasting hat on and kind of starts interviewing me. And I try to keep things going the way I normally do in my podcast. And that kind of goes off the rails here and there. So this is a very lively podcast for one of my favorite people. And I was truly grateful that she agreed to do this, because she has a lot going on and she is massively successful and extremely busy. So I hope you enjoy this free-form, fun, hilarious interview with Anna Faris. Enjoy.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation. Subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save big money at Menards.
Winter is coming.
I'm not sure if, as you are prepared to meet almost certain doom, if maybe being a little tipsy isn't the way to go into it.
So it's time to join Survivor's Rob Cisternino on post-show recaps as he brings you highlights of the biggest television event of the year.
Other than the dragons, whose job is it to take out the Night King?
Download new episodes of post-show recaps every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. Dragons not included.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is the Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Thank you. All right. Hi, everybody.
A master storyteller.
Thank you. This is my first live event, so this could go really badly, and you might never hear it. Thank you to LinkedIn Local, Beverly Hills Live, for doing this. This is great. And thank you for the Lux Rodeo Drive Hotel, which we're at right now. And thank you to Anna Faris, who is, I figured if we're going to do a live event,
who better to put foot in mouth.
Right, so let's get right into this, because okay. I'm going to start by saying that Vulture Magazine called you the most talented comic actress of her generation.
Oh, God.
And I would totally agree.
A lot of pressure
I would
there.
Agree. And here's the thing. I want to get into how you got into comedy, because you were born in Baltimore, Maryland. You have a father who's a professor, Jack, and Karen, who was a stay-at-home mom. And so I have a daughter who's 11, and she loves comedy. I don't know where she gets it. And she really wants to be an actress and wants to be a comic actress. And one of the things she said was she thought maybe she wanted to do stand-up, and we were shooting tag in Atlanta. Isla Fisher goes, you don't want to do stand-up. You want to do theater, and you want to get good at telling stories, and you want to get good at playing characters. So you've described yourself as a theater dork, and you started off at 9.
Well, okay, wait. First, I want to get back to
the greatest comic actress of her generation.
Oh God,
I can say it again.
I'll get into that in a second, because I feel like I sort of stumbled on into the comedic world and I can't get out. But but would you want your daughter to be an actor?
I want my daughter to do whatever she wants to do, and I find the arts really rewarding, and I think that. My son has zero interest in the movie business, and it's ironic because I'm a movie producer, and his stepdad, who's a really good friend of mine, is also a movie producer. So he's grown up on sets and has zero interest. So the fact that my daughter wants to do comedy makes me happy, because she's really funny.
I'm sure that she's probably aware of like the judgment and challenges, right?
Yes. She's listened to my podcast. So, yes, she knows I'm being judged and challenged every day. Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, that's the thing. But I think it's worth it. And I think that if you love something, anything is worth it. And you have to dig in and do it. Why did you start at 9?
Is it, Todd?
It is. You're going to be okay, Anna.
No,
You're on a huge hit TV show.
My mom enrolled me
full Elvis right
into
now?
Some – well, yeah, I know. I do feel like – What do we do?
This is good. Okay. Now it just becomes a Vegas act. All right, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Tip
your waitress on the way out. Yeah, I think you pull it that way towards you.
I don't know if I want to hold it.
Oh, I do.
Okay, I know.
I may walk.
My mom enrolled me in like a bunch of, you know, whatever, like dinky classes when I was a kid. I grew up in the suburbs, sort of a blue collar area, north of Seattle. That's maybe inaccurate. I didn't have a pool. We didn't. Nobody I knew had a pool.
Is there a blue collar area of Seattle, by the way? It feels like it's all pretty white collar.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. but anyway, she stuck me in a drama class when I was 6. And I got to be like a lobster, and I just loved it. I loved, being. I know this doesn't sound totally relevant, but I was a very short child, and I come from a pretty tall family, and so I had this need to be taken seriously and to be heard, and so where this comes into relevance is how I ended up in comedy, because I was such a determined, ferocious kid. I was always dismissed or just not taken seriously. So I needed to have that outlet of drama. So I grew up doing theater in Seattle, and my parents were never stage parents, but they did sacrifice a lot in our family for. Would you like me to do a few monologues?
Yeah.
From
let's do it.
No. but so then I went to college and
studied English literature, correct?
Yeah, well.
Okay.
I mean, that's what I majored in.
Okay.
That's what, like, I got my diploma in.
Right.
Did
on.
I actually finish a book? I'm not sure. But then I auditioned for Scary Movie, and I couldn't believe that I got it. And then my life has been in the comedic world. And then I've recounted this this story a bit, but, you know, when I got Scary Movie, I called my college roommate, and I said, I got cast in this comedy. And she's like, oh, but you're not funny. And it's true. I felt like I know. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get fired because I don't – like, I think I'm taking this too seriously. And then the director of Scary Movie, Keenan Ivory Wayans, told me that that I didn't know what it was about me that made me funny, which was – well – planted a seed that I've really sat with, you know, for a long ass time. And I've come to the conclusion that I just think I don't know what my face is doing.
That's amazing.
So there we go, that's Todd. Amazing. Bye.
So the director says, that's good face. Keep doing that.
Yeah. No, this is, no. Yeah, I wish, but no.
Before we go back to being a theater nerd, this is the thing about the movie business, which is so fascinating. I've been doing this a long time, and I was an executive for a long time and a producer for a long time, and you realize how small the community is. So you've worked with the Wayans brothers, as have I. You've worked with Adam Sandler's company, as have I. And you and I have circled each other professionally numerous times.
Never hired me. It's fine.
Well, to be fair, those movies didn't get made.
Cool,
so
cool. I'll just do your podcast.
Hey, we got to at least. Hey, you got to start somewhere. I've worked with your significant other.
Yeah.
He was a DP on my movie Zookeeper. So it's like it's a weirdly small world, and it just I'm going to bury the lead here. Be nice to people. If you're listening to this, you have to be a good person. You have to be nice to people. And you know the old adage of you'll meet everybody on the way up, the same people you meet on the way down, is so true. And if you're not good to people and honest, but if you can't be nice, at least be honest, because you will run into people time and time and time again and work with the same people, and it's such a small pool.
Yeah, I love it that you bring up that point because. I did a movie where one of the producers got his start being assistant craft service guy, and then you work with people that you remember that you know was an assistant. Like we all start with the dinky commercials or the rejection or so. You and I have worked with people who value valuable people, but don't value what they view as invaluable people, and that is a big mistake.
Right?
Right?
Yeah. I mean, well, everybody's valuable. I mean, people, anybody that's on.
But
a movie
do you know set, what I'm saying?
I
what,
do.
Like the perception of like, well, what are you going to do for me? I
right.
don't need to pay attention to you, and that's not great for the soul, but it's also you don't know what brilliance is out there, I like to think that the industry is changing in terms of, I don't know if I'm right about this, in terms of how people are perceived, because opportunity is different now. And I like to think that people are being respected sort of no matter what they do. Am I just a ding-dong for thinking that?
No, it definitely is changing. And for the better, I think. And I think anytime you can have a conversation.
I love it that I just made your sound guy laugh with ding dong. I think that he's probably like watching like
he's actually watching.
He's like watching YouTube or something.
He's watching Stranger Things right
ding,
now.
Ding dong.
So no, it is a good point because I think the industry is changing for the better, and I think that anytime you can have an open conversation about those issues and about the way people are treated is always a really good thing.
So who are you going to talk shit about? Come on, Todd.
No, nobody. So I want to go back to this because you did the Scary Movie films where you played Cindy Campbell. You've done Lost in Translation. You did House Bunny, Observe and Report, Overboard, and you've done all these voices for Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and Alvin and Chipmunks.
You're missing Lover's Lane.
Lover's Lane, where you were a cheerleader in 1999 who got gutted.
Yeah.
And you're also, I was going to leave that out, but if you want to bring it up. And you're also on this hit TV show, Mom.
obviously, and you were called by Vulture Magazine the comic actors of her generation.
This makes me so uncomfortable.
Sorry, that's good. That's what I do.
Well, because I truly don't know.
That's my point. Yeah. My point is you've done all these movies. Honestly, when did you know you were funny?
Because the idea of sincerity of character, I think, is sort of I don't know if I could ever do stand up, and I don't know. I think the combination of sincerity of character, and then getting older and feeling like, well, how much can we swear here?
Can you say anything you want, because he's going to bleep it. So say or whatever you want to say.
Well, because I think there is like a point in your life when you are like, fuck it, there's a freedom in honesty. And so the idea of being like, yeah, you know, I'm like flawed. I mean, not that flawed.
Right.
But I was surprised when I moved here. This is like that there was such a differentiation between dramatic acting and comedic acting.
Comedic acting's harder.
Well, I didn't think that there was a difference.
I think it is.
And
not to say that you're a great dramatic actress too, because I think the performance in Lost in Translation is hard to do. To be self-aware enough to know all of those nuances of
I wasn't aware.
But not to get all Barbara Walters here, but then to keep digging into this thing, you've been to previews, you've been to premieres, people laughing their ass off at your performance. Did any of that resonate with you? Did you go, oh, wow, I'm funny?
I think that there's like the vulnerability of like, do people actually believe, especially in my 20s with the scary movies, do people actually believe that I am as stupid as Cindy Campbell? Maybe I am. There's a high likelihood. So I think that you have to give up a little bit of that, the idea of public perception, but it also makes you very defensive. I mean, you've talked to a ton of comedians.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Like,
it's a hard. Because you're the most vulnerable. You're putting yourself up 50 feet high, and you are bearing a little piece of yourself, even though it might be a broad comedy. There still is a piece of you that's going out there.
I got sprayed to the ceiling.
Right, that is true.
In my first, with sperm. Right. Yeah, in my first movie. My parents were like, my mom.
A lot of sacrifice.
Like, I just wanted you to be Amelia Earhart or Margaret Thatcher or anything else.
You're Anna Faris now. Are you kidding me? So now when you go up for auditions and you're looking for roles, what makes you excited? Like, what gets you going in terms of, you know, the roles you're taking now and the kind of things you're attracted to?
I love this is a good question for you, though. Don't you think that that actors and all of us now have to be more proactive?
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that what excites me is creation. Like, I love like thinking of a character. When I pitched the character idea of House Bunny to the writers who wrote Legally Blonde, Kirsten Smith and Karen Lutz, who are brilliant and wonderful. Originally, I was like, I don't know, I'm thinking about this, you know, lower echelon Playboy bunny who gets kicked out. Like, she's not like one of the girlfriends, but maybe she's too old. Maybe she, like, you know, won't go down on somebody, or maybe she has a meth addiction and she has to go back to like her southern like Christian town with her abusive stepfather, and I'm sort of like rambling
first three
on.
Yes, the rest not so much.
Like, or she could become a house mom at a sorority.
Right.
I was like, all right, that sounds good.
And so do you remember the movies or the performances that inspired you?
Yes, I do. But just to get back to your point a little bit, but is it the idea of the necessity? Because I was at a point when I was pitching House Bunny, at a point in my career where I felt like I wasn't going to work.
Right.
And it did feel like, all right, so how do I stay here? Do I go back to Seattle. And I think that we all have those moments where it is like, so what avenues do we take in this shifting environment? And so that felt amazing to actually, after 24 pitches, we sold it to Happy Madison and Sony, and they made it. And that was amazing. But it was that thing of like the traditional, what I had known in Hollywood for the first 5 years was auditioning,
right,
and then getting a role. Then it was like, all right, things that you can feel the shift, whether it was within me or like where I was, position wise, or whether it was the town shifting, but that need to be proactive.
Well, I think that's amazing. I think that all comedians need to do, well, actors probably in general, but definitely comedians need to do that. I've spoken to, you know, pretty much every comedian I've ever worked with, and unless you write,
you've spoken to every comedian you've ever worked with.
I did. Some I tried not to, but I did. About
good
I
for say, you, Todd.
I know this didn't come out the way I wanted to. Spoken to them about this topic.
Okay. All right. Wow, good qualifier. Bye.
So, and that you need to write for yourself, or at least need to produce for yourself,
because
otherwise you will just get the roles that they think you should be in. So, like, you know, how many times can you play Cindy Campbell? Because the general business will be like, well, she played Cindy Campbell before, that's what she can do. And so, like, you know, like Sandler writes, Kevin James writes, you know, Will Ferrell writes, Judd Apatow, the Seth and Evan, they write for themselves because they know what they'd be best at. They know what they can do. They know what makes them laugh,
right,
what they'll be really funny at, as opposed to just another, you know, scary movie or another iteration of a scary movie.
And I think there was a time too when I felt like I was playing I felt like the bounce board to a male lead,
right,
where, and I didn't feel hot enough to be that character, mm-hmm, or that the character was interesting enough to, so it was like I was like the, you know, series of faces, which
according to Keenan Wayans, was
actually
a good thing.
I actually just am. I'm a series of faces.
Do you remember? Going back to my other question, do you remember movies or performances that really just blew you away, that inspired you? But they don't even have to be comedic.
Oh, I think, you know, Steve Martin in The Jerk. And Bernadette Peters in The Jerk.
Amazing.
I love Goldie Hawn. Betty White. I loved but having said that, like, I took myself too seriously. I was at that age where when I would watch those performances, I would be dismissive and not understand actually how valuable the role of, you know, the sincere innocent can be, or the person that gives sort of the heart that you don't realize, you know, to a performance. And that's it. That's all I got.
Okay. And so now...
No, Todd, I do have a lot more, but yes.
That's okay. And so now when you're preparing for a movie or a role, knowing what you know now, having gone through as many movies... Like, what do you think about? Like, what is the way you prepare it? And what is the way you like to work on set? Like, what makes you feel comfortable? Because this is getting into being a producer, which you, by the way, by coming up with the idea for House Bunny and now in your career, what do you look for in a producer? Like, what makes you feel safe, metaphorically and literally, on set? Like, for so you can give the best performance.
Shit, Todd, I don't know. Like,
well, this is
I don't think said. I've ever felt safe.
Oh, well, that's
certainly not
good.
Right now. You see, I feel like my cheeks are like burning up.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
I'm sorry.
I just didn't know it was going to be so painful.
But to give your best performance, and when you're preparing, like, what's been your great experiences? Like, who are the, what are the movie sets, and who are the producers that have been like, you know, completely supportive? So you went, "Fuck it, I can be my best."
I think. An environment where, like, probably like Smiley Face and House Bunny, I think were my most they were my favorite filming experiences, because it felt like a collaboration. Like, I felt, and it may have not been it may have just been people just being like, all right, yeah, we'll give that a whirl. But at least I felt heard, and I wanted to play, but in House Bunny had a much larger budget. I mean, Smiley Face was made for $1 million here in L.A. Could that even be done anymore?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it can be done. I mean, people are
doing
it.
You want to give us $1 million?
So we can start shooting right now.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I think that's a huge point in terms of people coming up through the business or people that are in the business that are producers or that have control of a set is collaboration is so important. And I know it's like parenting, right? It could be faster to just like make your kids do what you want them to do, but it's so much better when everybody's on the same page and you can get what you want out of them.
But
I don't mean that you're a child.
No.
I'm just saying that's what it feels like to me. It feels like a family when you're making a movie.
Can you, having made so many movies, can you gauge when there's an actor who, because I do like to think that I don't want to waste anybody's time. At the end of the day, we all want to go home. But can you gauge pretty quickly when an actor is being high maintenance to just be heard, mm-hmm. or when an idea actually resonates? Like, can you?
Well, I try to nip that in the bud beforehand. So, like this last movie that I did, we had John Cena, Keegan-Michael Key, Judy Greer, and John Leguizamo, all veteran actors.
I mean, right.
And John, we had gone through his notes process, so I'm going to take Cena. I'm going to take him out of this for a second. But you have Keegan-Michael Key, you have John Leguizamo and Judy Greer, all phenomenal actors, all phenomenal comedians. And so what I did is I said, all right, hey, guys, you're going to show up in the production office. This is a week before shooting. We're going to show up before we rehearse. We're going to sit in a room for as long as it takes, and we're going to go page by page, and you're going to tell me your thoughts on every line that you have in this movie. And can you make it better? And why is this not working? And what more can you bring? And so we just sat there and we went through it. And Judy, who I did 13 Going on 30 with, she was blown away because she was like, well, you know, how about this line? How about this? And just to be heard, and not just to be heard like in a bullshitty way, like, that's funny.
But
to
so
really
good.
Understand, she's amazing. And the movie got better for it on every front. So that by the time we started shooting, everybody had been heard. And even sometimes people would say, oh, I know I said that before, but I'm starting to like doubt that a little bit. Cool. Let's fix it. You know, Judy's just got into knitting. So then just little things, like her character had a bunch of knitted things in her set, just made her happy because she could figure out her character better. And Keegan is a completely different actor than John Leguizamo. Keegan, you can just say, okay, we're going to set up two cameras. This is the edge of the frame. This is the edge of the frame. Go. And you shoot for 10 minutes, and he goes unconscious because he's so good at improv that you just stand back and let him go, and then you call cut, and he goes, I have no idea what I just said. And then you try to remind him and say, okay, we can play off of that. And Leguizamo is a guy who really has been doing this for a long time and is a phenomenal writer who would email me in the middle of the night and say, hey, tomorrow's work, I'm thinking of this. And if you get the understanding of why that note comes and not just be like, are you joking? Then everybody feels safe. Everybody feels better, and you can do your best work. That's how I run my sets.
Okay, so what you're saying is the job of a producer is to manage just a shit ton of fucking insane people.
Yeah. Starting with myself. Every morning I wake up and go, we have to do this today. Get up. Everybody's counting on you. It's going to be okay. You're going to be fine. It's not all ending today. You're going to make it one more day. Yes. Yeah, it really is. And so good luck with this as you start to embark on this next
Thanks,
phase
Todd.
Of your career. So
it's a podcast filled with hope.
I try. So I do, that is true. I do feel that way. I feel like I'm making a movie as opposed to making my movie. And I think that's where people get into trouble is if you are and there are certain people that have every right to do it. And, you know, Quentin Tarantino is making his movie and God bless him. And it's amazing. And I can't wait to see it. But I think he also – I've never worked with him. But the people who have worked with him, it's very collaborative. He listens. He's every actor that wants to work with him 10 times like Scorsese. Beyond that, for a producer – and I listened to – the producer who did Roma, and she said, my job every day was to wake up and make sure that that movie was the movie that he wanted to make. And so as a good producer will figure out, okay, whose movie is this? Is it the director's movie? Is it the lead actor's movie? And then you have to manage all of the other people to make sure that they're all going in the same direction. And where I think, going back to your actor thing, if you cast the wrong people where it's an Anna Faris movie and then I cast an actor who's like, this is a Joe, you know, Frankenberry movie, and Joe Frankenberry is like, I'm going to come to set and figure out how to make it my movie every day, that's where things get crazy. And I never try to get that to that place, because I am brutally honest and will go to Joe and say, this is an Anna Faris movie, we should just nip this in the bud right now.
Go on. how do you feel about the challenge of working with a first-time director?
Well, I worked with a first-time director on Tag, and I enjoyed every second of it. Jeff Tomsic was a dream.
But has that happened a lot in your career?
Oh, yeah. I worked with Simon West's first movie was Con Air. Pretty much Bruckheimer, every movie that we made, with the exception of when he hired Ridley Scott for Black Hawk Down or Tony Scott for Enemy of the State, pretty much all the other movies that we did together were first-time directors. He loved it because they were making Jerry Bruckheimer movies, and he has a certain aesthetic. I don't know if you guys saw the Gemini Man trailer today. To this day, it's Ang Lee, and it still looks like a Bruckheimer movie. It's just the way that it is. And so if, as long as everybody's in the boat rowing in the same direction, he's weirdly very hands-off. He'll let people do it, but everybody knows what's expected.
Weirdly hands off. I mean,
no, but I don't mean hands off in a way that
no,
like he doesn't like. He
I
doesn't
mean, like if you're Jerry Bruckheimer, you got like your big old boat.
No. He's on. No,
but it's like, he's yeah, on, you deal with
no,
it.
No, no. He's on set every day, but he's confident to know that everybody knows what they're expected to do. So for
Sorry,
me,
Jerry.
when
didn't
we're working,
mean to imply that you weren't there every day.
He knows he was. When I'm working with a first time director like on Tag, that was such a challenge because we had so many great actors, and it was an ensemble, and this is this poor gentleman's first movie, Jeff Tomsic, and I have pictures of, you know, 11 marks that we had to like cover because you had this giant cast of characters, all very smart with points of view, and he just decided he's making Tag. He's not trying to do anything other than what's best for the movie. So if John Hamm had a great note, done. Isla Fisher, she had a great note, which she had many. Done. Jeremy Renner came in. So as long as everybody's doing the best for the movie, it's not that hard. It's what happens is if somebody is feeling like, I'm not being heard and I'm going to go in my shell and I'm going to act up, then nobody's getting the best out of that person. And that never works. And that's not the best way to make a movie. Right? No, you don't need to clap. No. And so now you want to be, you know, not want to be, you are producing. You have a company called Bob Was Here Productions.
Yeah.
And so I think it's great. And I think everybody who is in the business should take charge of their own destiny and should do it. What made you really decide, I want to do this?
Well, I think that, you know, like we talked about earlier, that there's a necessity mm-hmm. to and I don't know if it's particular to my career. But I think that it's the shift in like actors' careers in general
yeah.
because of how there's now all these different avenues to succeed and to fail or whatever. But that where we could be proactive in a way that we can't. And I also want to play characters that. That are like, you know, fucking losers.
Right.
And
you want your Breaking Bad.
To, well, is he a loser?
No, but I mean, something I mean, that's something's off brand mm-hmm. because he was like known as a very jovial, comedic actor who suddenly turned it around.
Yeah,
not turned it around.
Yeah.
I mean, turned it on its head.
Yeah. I want to be, I have like specific characters in mind that I really want to play.
That you know you can play. And then maybe people don't know that you can play them, so you want to take your destiny in your own hands.
Yes. Well, I do think I can play them.
Yeah. No,
it's just a matter
I'm sure you can.
Todd, if you believe me. because I need but you I to
think
produce that's, them.
No, but I but what I think is
I need you to get me the money. Get but me the I, money, Todd. But, why the fuck am I here?
But I, by the way, Anna thought this was a general meeting for a movie, guys. Don't tell her. See, so I, but I think that's great. I think that every, you look at like when Margot Robbie did it last year, right, with I, Tonya. She went out and got that script. I wanted it bad. I really wanted to produce that movie badly, and I got beaten out.
You would have cast me, wouldn't you?
Well, no, she went out and found that part and knew she could play it, but nobody
didn't
thought
want to ice skate anyone.
Pretty Australian Margot Robbie could play Tonya Harding, and she knew she could. And I think that's what's great about this business is that you can now, with all of the different avenues, as you said, between Netflix and all the streamers and the proliferation of all of the different networks, you can kind of do your – like look at – do you – anybody watch Schitt's Creek? Like you just see Eugene Levy and his son went, let's just – like yeah. Eugene Levy could get cast yeah. forever as Eugene Levy. And by the way, Eugene Levy has been 10 degrees of Eugene Levy for 20 years. His son and he created the show called Schitt's Creek. And you just see that they're having so much fun because they just decided, what do we want to do? Like, what's our style of comedy? And, you know, they got all their, you know, unbelievable actor friends to participate. And it's been on for 4 seasons going into its 5th season on Netflix. That's what's exciting is that anybody now can take control of their own
destiny.
But wait,
but what would you, what advice would you give to somebody who just arrived?
Right.
Who like didn't like I mean because on occasion like I'll get asked some like a version of that and I think that I mean because there isn't like a 1-800 number that you call that it's like okay here no. you go to like you know and then this is the ladder because there's no conventional ladder in this industry. So what advice would you give to
somebody. Well, weirdly, the advice is the same for somebody who just got here as someone who's been in the business for 10 years or 20 years, which is just do it. So time and time again on this podcast, and then we'll talk about podcasting in a second. Time and time again on this podcast, what I have found fascinating, which I kind of knew in the back of my head, but it has not been really brought to light to me until I actually sat down with a lot of my friends and I went, how did you do it? How did you get into the business? And to a person, they said, oh, I knew one person. They weren't even in the business, but they knew this one person. And because of their drive and their talent and their determination, they went through this channel, found that one person, and worked their way and became successful. So follow your gut. And this, by the way, for anybody who's been 10 years, 15 years, or just arriving in a plane right now, follow your gut, follow the trail of it, because I, you know, I do believe there's a, you know, 75% skill, 25% luck. Luck being somebody says to you, oh, I know this person over here. Go talk to them. Do it. And you talk to them, and that leads to the other thing. So I would say if someone's been in 10 years and they're in a little bit of a rut too, like just listen. Somebody might go, you know what? There's this movie. I don't know. Maybe you'd be right for it. You might want to meet this person. And then you meet this person. So there's a really good friend of mine who I'll embarrass right now named Peter Safran, who I'm trying to get on the show. He's a great producer. He's been a producer.
Did you want Peter?
I want Peter on the show too. Like, no, I wanted you for this, but I want Peter later.
And I was. It's fine. It's cool.
But he's a great story because he's a great producer.
Just glad I'm getting paid so much.
he's a great producer who found The Conjuring. And so, by the way, Amityville Horror had been done. He went to the Warrens. He got the rights. He worked hard to get the rights. He secured those rights. He went and he sold it to Lionsgate. Lionsgate thought, these rights are really complicated. It's a lot of work. And basically dumped the project. And he didn't give up. And he went and took the rights to New Line. And they made The Conjuring, which has now become a universe. He also hired James Wan, who was coming off The Saw.
Okay, this is an awesome story. I don't mean to interrupt you. But what do you do when you...
I'm saying he followed this trail.
Okay.
And now he's producing Suicide Squad, Aquaman, and
he's
Shazam.
Got a yacht. Off
no,
of
I know.
Debris.
But think about it. It started from one thing. It started from
listen,
one small
I so
rights
believe you.
Acquirement.
And I do think. Well, then that's an interesting idea. Like one small rights acquirement is interesting. But most people like don't have the avenue to like.
He went into the Warrens. it was out there. People knew Amityville Horror. It's been around forever. He went to them and said, hey, I think there's a different way in. It's always been done from the point of view of the people who lived in the house. It's never been done from the paranormal investigators who found the ghost.
I have no idea what you just said. It's
trust
always
me.
Been done
trust me,
it's from the investigators.
Yeah. No,
in
the other way.
It's never been done.
Amityville has always been done from the people who lived in the house. And the house says get out and they don't leave.
Right, gotcha.
But this, Peter went and got the rights to the people who were brought in to investigate this paranormal activity. And did their story, and this created this whole franchise. What
Do you
I'm
believe
saying,
in ghosts?
Is, oh my god! What I'm saying is, it only takes one thing. That's
yes,
the thing.
Yeah,
one thing.
Yeah,
you can find one rights deal or one
or
article.
One person.
That's right.
That is like that
so that's
inspires
my advice.
You.
Follow that, or that, follow the one person or the one thing, and let that. Don't get overwhelmed by. Well, I don't know, Oprah. I mean, all right, you don't, but. Follow the people you do, and eventually, if you want to persist, you will.
Do you know Oprah?
I don't.
I bet you do.
I don't. I don't
you
know Oprah.
Do. You I totally don't. Do. You know Oprah. Oh my God! Look at you. You're.
I swear, I don't know Oprah. So let's talk about podcasting because you're also an author.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And you have taken a little bit of a break from podcasting because you were on your show, and you're going to start your show up again, which is so huge. By the way,
Do you watch it every Thursday?
Mom? Uh-huh. No, I know that. Everybody knows that's huge. But your podcast was unbelievably huge.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
So,
yeah.
And you're going to answer your own question because you're going to talk about podcasting and it's going to completely parallel what you should do in the business.
Okay.
How did you start podcasting?
So, well, yeah.
Oh, look at that. The light just went on.
Man, you. Here I am. Being all. Stupidly smug. And turns out.
How did you start podcasting?
Bringing it all back around.
Tell the audience how you started podcasting.
So, no, I like listening to podcasts, and I was doing Mom. It was, I think, our second end of first season. And I was feeling very, because in that format, which is something that I didn't know, there's not out of structure, there isn't a lot of creative collaboration at all. So I felt like I needed an outlet. I contractually, anybody in that world isn't allowed to really explore too many things, which is a whole other whatever. But so I thought, I don't know, I'm going to start a podcast and I'll just do this as my like Sunday hobby. And my dream was to reach out to strangers and attempt to give them advice and just talk to them outside of, I liked the idea of talking to people that I didn't know without the celebrity framework,
right?
A bit, and that sounds really lofty, but I did because I wanted to be able to talk to them. I mean, listen, there's nothing like I'm a jerk through and through, I think, but started this podcast, and then. And then it felt very therapeutic, and it was
very
really
genuine and from your heart.
Thanks,
and super honest.
Where are you going? Where are you going? Hey guys, come back. This is really good stuff.
And super
really good stuff. Tell me about your relationship. I'm here to help.
And super authentic. And by the way, this suddenly turned into like the Comedy Store. Hi.
No, but
you just turned into Sarah Silverman in front of our eyes. See, you can do stand up.
Well.
So you, but it's very authentic and from your heart, and it's a place. Look, by the way, network sitcoms. You're on a hugely successful sitcom with unbelievable writers. Nick Pakai is a friend of mine. Chuck Lorre is the gold standard. You're given great shit to say every weekend and week out, and it is a grind because. Of the schedule, and the stuff you're doing is phenomenal, and you're obviously hugely popular for it. But I understand from your heart you wanted to talk authentically about who is Anna Faris and have conversations that weren't like on set conversations. Like, how was your weekend?
I did like the idea of being and it was always important to me to like not film,
right?
My podcast?
I have no idea what these cameras are. They won't be used anywhere. I only have 400 followers. You'll be fine.
But but I liked the idea of like of this odd intimacy that podcasting provides. And it feels really good. I know you feel that way, right?
I do.
I mean, I guess we just get to talk.
Yeah. I'm definitely not doing it for the money.
Who knows if we're saying anything of interest?
Right. Well, that's the thing that for me, I mean, I've told this story a million times. There's a few reasons why I started doing it. The most profound probably was just, like you said, you want to have conversations without the veil of celebrity. I don't have that problem. But the thing I did have was a number of conversations with my friends who are producers that I really started to think, man, if I had heard this when I was 17 or 18 or a student or even in the business, like as an assistant or whatever, that would be really cool. And I had one specific conversation with Kevin Riley, who's now running all of the streaming for Turner. And we sat for 2 hours and just over a couple drinks and talked about the TV business because I didn't know really that much about it. And I went away thinking, gosh, man, people should have heard that. It was really an interesting conversation. I learned a ton. And so that's for me. And I'm learning so much, even tonight.
Sweet.
I'm just messing with you. I'm learning so much from everybody that I talk to that that's what really keeps me going. It's just like, if I'm learning and I've been doing this for so long, people got to be getting something from it if they're interested in the subject matter. You were doing something that was so much broader and so much more heartfelt and deep. That's a way tougher thing that I don't think I could do.
What?
What?
What are you talking about? I can't believe you're just like volleying back to me. You. Come on. Oh, I don't think I could do what you do. Oh, come on, Todd.
So how will this, now that you've done this podcast and you've now felt this intimacy and you felt like this kind of power of your voice, how will that affect your producing and the projects that you take?
Wait, so am I a producer that's taking projects?
No, you're producing that producer that's creating projects. Well, I know, because Michael and I are going to talk and get some movies going with you.
I love it. I love that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that I really want to listen. I want to listen to, like, I want your guidance. I want to be aware, but I do, like you said, there's that balance of like trusting your gut and awareness. And do things need to be ruled with, like a Lannister with an iron fist?
No.
Because we've worked with, people who can be incredibly tough, and it makes, it makes you feel like you, are, not only do you dread like the long ass days, and there is that pressure of like, but I'm living my dream, and so I should be really grateful, but I'm also giving up sacrificing everything for this,
right,
for this dream.
So it better be something you love.
So I think you do a really amazing job sort of balancing that as a producer with people not feeling completely miserable, because maybe early on you must have been on like
no
those
I
jobs
mean I think
or something.
I no
know.
It definitely is a learning curve too, because when you're in your 20s you don't really have the concept of like what people are sacrificing to make movies. You just sort of go, like a shark, you kind of just keep swimming forward. Now, having kids, knowing what people are giving up, knowing that people are on set, knowing that people are leaving their families for 40 to 100 days. Michael and I worked on a movie that was 100 days. We worked 85 nights. And so, like, that's brutal, man. And it's hard to do that. And it is. And
there's nothing better than that hot shower, though.
That is true.
7 in the morning.
And so, since I know that, I think I've got a better understanding to not make it miserable.
I like to think, and somebody asked, can I get to this or no?
We'll do questions in 2 seconds.
Okay,
I have
fine,
two
fine.
More questions of
okay,
you.
Fine.
Things I like to ask. Okay, so if you now could talk to your 18-year-old self, or someone who's 18 and wants to get into the business and admires you and is a fan, what advice would you give them to get into the business?
okay, first of all, that fucking bitch would not talk to me. She would be like, "Man, I was an angry kid." I think, oh, at 18.
Or any student or anybody in here who wants to be in the business.
I think that there is. I'm proud that I held on to my pride, which I know that sounds crazy, being sprayed to the ceiling, with the sperm, but I always had like a sense of like, there were just certain things I didn't want to compromise with, and I did believe, I had this youthful arrogance at times where it was like, I feel like I'm good. I may be better than some of these people, and I feel embarrassed to admit that, but that was how I felt, and I didn't ever admit that until now, which now I feel like regretful that I just did. But I did think that something about that inner drive carried me through.
Good.
And I, you know, I wasn't a great student, and I wasn't as smart as my brother or whatever. But I did feel like I had a passion that. And I didn't think I was going to make it at all. I just didn't want. I just knew that I did not want to be taken advantage of.
Right.
And that felt like it was that in and of itself felt like it
that's
was
a
enough.
Great driver. And then this is a question I always ask, and you can pick any set or any show. Best day on set.
Oh, best day on set.
Oh, it could be more than one.
Oh man.
When you met Michael. Yeah. He's sitting right there. Besides when you met Michael.
Besides when I met Michael. I think we making the House Bunny, we shot the first the Playboy Bunny the Playboy Mansion sequence first. So we were at the mansion and we were doing a night shoot, and Shaquille O'Neal was there, and it was like day four of shooting, and I'm in this crazy costume with these massive stripper heels, and we had this very strict choreographer who was very frustrated with me, and it just looking around and thinking like, I can't believe that this was something that I just couldn't. It was so surreal. It was so euphorically surreal, and I'm trying to do the steps, and I can't really do them. And it was my character's birthday, and the next day she gets kicked out because she's too old. But it was one of those moments where it's like, I had a hand in making this, and in these people having jobs, and they're all like excited to be, I mean, it's a Playboy Mansion, so of course everyone's excited to be there or whatever. but that felt amazing. That was amazing. And Shaquille picks me up, and you know, it was great.
Awesome. I have those exact moments.
That's
Anna Faris, everybody.
Shaquille
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Oh, we're not going to. Okay.
So we have what? We got two. Wait.
Oh,
so
okay.
First of all, you're going first. Ladies first. So we have two questions that we want to just answer real quick.
I don't think that's a quick one, but it's a good one.
No. I don't mean quick. I have nothing
else
to do.
This question is, what is the most promising shift you're seeing in Hollywood today? Which is a fascinating question. And I wish I could answer it well. I think that between the opportunity to be proactive, the thirst that everyone can see for different content is. I love that things. It does, especially in the world of comedy, which always has to evolve. I love that there's that, and it's always frustrating when things take Hollywood a little bit by surprise in terms of the success of a movie. not that, I mean, it's always hard to predict, but it's frustrating and gratifying because it's like, why are we one step behind in terms of content? And I love the idea of genre fluidity. But I think that has to be finessed. But I think that that whole world is sort of opening up, and content fluidity too, I guess. I don't know what I'm talking about.
That was good.
Yes,
and
I feel like that was
no, it was great.
Okay,
let me yes and it.
Yeah,
it's just an improv exercise.
Yeah, that's fine.
So, I think that the best positive outlook is just how many people want content now, and so if you're somebody who wants to make things, which is different than wants to get rich or be a powerful producer. If you want to make things, genuinely want to make things, then the barriers to entry are so low now in terms of you don't have to scale the 20-foot wall around Paramount Pictures. You can make something and put it.
Yep, you that ice dragon.
You can podcast.
He just burned that wall down.
That's right.
It's gone. So,
or you can go on streaming.
Everybody's welcome.
Or you can go on YouTube Red, or you can go on Hulu. There's so many avenues that want different kinds of content, and everybody is trying to brand their own distribution channel. So some channels don't even know what the brand is. So Hulu, you know, couldn't figure out what it was, and then they get one show and it becomes that show. And then, you know, in the way back machine, when Sex and the City happened, that was HBO's brand. Now it's Game of Thrones. So it's really exciting that all these places, YouTube Red hasn't really figured it out yet.
I think that to your point, and I'll just wrap this up too, but that there's never been a better time to take a super weird creative risk.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because
so many shows.
Like a point of view.
Barry, for example.
But even like, I don't know, like somebody like just picking radishes out of the ground
right.
on like, my radish YouTube channel. Does anyone want to help me grow radishes? We serve them with French butter. We just slowly eat them. That's it.
I guarantee
Three
you
minutes.
People would watch that if you did that. I guarantee people would.
Thanks, Todd.
And then the other question is, this is my favorite one because there is no real answer to it. So the agenting packaging freeze right now that the talent agents and the writers are in this argument. I'm really the wrong person to ask because if you've ever listened to my podcast, I took Billy Ray to task that the writer strike was worthless, and then he completely unraveled every argument that I had. So I think the answer is both are right and both are wrong. I mean, I think that the WJ has a very valid point that if somebody is packaging their television shows with their talent that isn't in the best interest of the show, that doesn't behoove the writers. But I would also say that if a writer is not paying commission and you've had 10 strikeouts and you've had one hit and they finally take a packaging fee and the loss leader is all the 10 pilots that didn't get picked up and you never had to pay commission on that, that's also a valid point. So there is a negotiation that will work out. This is not going to be writers have to have agents eventually. And the packaging fee, the way I look at packaging fees, and Ted Chervin explained it, what a packaging fee is specifically on my podcast. But the way I look at packaging fees is like overhead for a movie studio. So if you look at a movie studio, the way it works is you have walls and you have buildings and you have people and you have salaries and you have all of the costs associated, which are the sunk costs to make a movie studio. So those costs are real and they don't go away. And so you have to charge them against something. You can't charge them against losses. So just for math, if you have a studio that has $100 million of overhead and you make 10 movies, theoretically you're going to put $10 million against all those 10 movies. Well, all 10 of those movies are not going to make money. Let's say 5 of them do. So those 5 movies are now going to incur $20 million of overhead. And if you're on the five movies that incur that $20 million in overhead, you're going to be like, what the hell? Why am I incurring $20 million of overhead? It should have been 10 or less, but that's just not the way the world works. So packaging fees, in essence, are the same thing, which is if you have 50 shows and they're not taking commission on any of them, they're taking packaging fees on all and only 5 go, those five people are going to be pissed off because they have to pay the lion's share of their of the packaging fee when all the other people didn't have to. That's the that's like the real baseline version of what everybody's arguing about. And what they're arguing about, the writers are, is agents have a fiduciary responsibility to do the best for their clients. And if packaging, if the lure of the packaging fee gets in the way of that, that is a problem and they shouldn't be doing that. I'm not saying they're doing that at all, and who knows if they are or aren't, but that's what the crux of the issue is. You want to take this one?
Yeah.
Thank
you. We're all kind of
well, thank
you. Pursue your dreams.
Pursue your dreams. Thank you so much, Anna, for doing
thank
this.
You
You're
so
the best.
Much.
Thank you, guys. And thank you, everybody,
thank
at
you
LinkedIn.
So
thank
much.
You so much.
Thank you. Thanks, Todd.
Hey, guys.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
And I definitely have to urinate.
Mike's alive still. We're going to keep that in, right? And
hey guys, it's Kelty Knight from the Lady Gang podcast. If you're into getting a very sassy, sexual, beautiful, inspiring, funny, oftentimes embarrassing, slightly anal podcast in your repertoire, subscribe to us, Lady Gang, on Podcast One, the Podcast One app. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save.